are listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, and welcome to Reality Sandwich, where every Thursday at noon, we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, body, spirit, community, economy, earth, all six areas of the Healthful Living model, and you can read more about that at healthfulliving.org. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist and, most importantly, healthful living advocate. And I'm here in the studio today with my co-host,
Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant.
Now, today in our show, we have in studio with us a colleague of ours, Jody Friedman. She is a Guild-certified Feldenkrais practitioner. And we've been wanting to learn a lot about this practice for quite a long time. So we're going to delve into that in just a few minutes and learn all about this amazing somatic bodywork practice that has so many different applications, and really curious about that, and we'll get to Jody in just a few minutes. But first, we have on the line, joining us in just a couple of quick seconds, Mark McAfee. He is the owner of Organic Pastures Dairy, raw milk producer down in Fresno, and we're going to get the update on what's going on with the raw milk situation here in California. Our listeners may know that back in the fall, we've gave extensive coverage to this raw milk uproar that was taking place as the state of California, particularly the CDFA, California Department of Food and Agriculture, snuck into law a coliform standard, and Mark will tell us a little bit about that, that really had nothing to do with the safety of raw milk, but was really pretty much out to try to sneakily get it off the market in California because they just don't like it and, you know, they're vilifying it, and they want to keep us from being healthy. But that's our opinion. And we pretty much called it out as it was, as really just, you know, something that shouldn't have happened, that sneakily happened, and that we really felt very firmly that justice would eventually be had. And I was very surprised to hear the first part of this year that the state was actually trying to go ahead and enforce this thing. And then I guess there was an injunction and then some other things. So let's see if we can get Mark on the line and get us caught up today, because there were some legal happenings just recently. Let's find out what's going on as far as protecting our raw milk. Mark, are you with us?
I sure am. Good afternoon.
Hi, Mark.
Hi.
So, Mark, can you give us an update? I mean, you've been working hard. We've been getting the emails, making phone calls to our legislators. Is justice prevailing? What's going on?
Well, we think so. Very few of us really out here in society understand the political process very well. Mm-hmm. And it's a really tough, interesting new culture to have to be engaged in. And so you kind of have to take your leadership from those that have been successful in that environment, that are lobbyists and professionals, and we've got the best working with us. And it's been so successful that, you know, all the callers calling in, talking to the various different committee members has been very, very good. And we've got, you know, unanimous support now from, you know, all of the different committees, and it's been really, really good. And our support's broadened to include the dairy industry as well. And we look forward to seeing it pass through the various other hurdles in the next 2 months to being passed into law.
Tell us a little bit more about this support you're getting, because I know early on there I think was at least one woman in the state that was really positive about raw milk, but there were a lot of other people not really totally understanding it, and so I'm curious what has changed and what's their new understanding.
Well, you know, Senator Dean Flores held 6 hours of Senate committee hearings that invited experts from around the world. And there were university representatives there, experts from around the world, who contributed greatly on expert panels to discuss the issue of raw milk and its safety. And so it's been very well vetted. The SB 201, the Fresh Raw Milk Act of 2008, has been very well vetted, and everybody's had their ability to contribute to its development. And as a result, it's a very, very strong model that other states may be able to use, in addition to California, as a national model or even perhaps international model for assuring safety of raw milk.
After hearing from all these different experts, what were some of their beliefs that have changed, or what are some of their new understandings about raw milk that they didn't have before?
We have to all understand and appreciate that fear and bacteriophobia is rampant in America, and a lot of money is made on that whole consideration. Experts shared in these hearings that good beneficial bacteria are absolutely critical to our health and our immune system function, and this is not something well appreciated by others that stand in the way of raw milk. And in fact, any bacteria is considered to be harmful and a contaminant. and there was no appreciation or value ever assigned to beneficial values of probiotic bacteria. So that's the big first stumbling block. That's the big stumbling block, is the sterile paradigm versus the living paradigm. And so you have to get by that before you can get political support.
And is that happening now?
It is, but it's happening in kind of a tough situation, because it, raw milk stands right in the face of what's been in power for so long.
Right.
Well, what I'm appreciating here is that, you know, rather than just replacing the, or trying to rescind AB 1735 or take that piece out of it, right, you've gone after this SB 201, which is the creation of a new standard, as you were saying, which can be utilized, you know, in other states, and meets their need for there to be some sort of standard or some sort of, quote, regulation.
What we found out in the hearings was that experts, Dr. Robert Irons, who's a nutritional physiologist, used to work with the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. I mean, this guy knows his stuff. I was saying that, you know, in California, potable water is allowed to have 100 coliforms in it. But yet they were going to only allow us to have 10 coliforms in raw milk, which is a living food that's biodiverse.
Wow.
And coliforms are a beneficial bacteria, much like what you find in yogurt. And the reason you would eat or drink raw milk is because it has all these wonderful populations of beneficial bacteria that are missing in our diets today.
Mm.
So that's just a kind of a shocking concept there. Of the disparity of the, you know, the intelligent science being applied. And a lot of this is political pressuring, market protection, political pressure from the FDA and other places. And what we're trying now is to strike out and be really positive and try to build relationships with those that regulate us and try to bridge some of these issues, because we have such tremendous outpouring of support from consumers. And, the university was not against us. They basically agreed with most of what the experts were saying about raw milk.
So, what's the new bill that you've put into, that you've helped create? What are some of the things that are in there that are going to help us?
Well, I have to compliment the various staffers at Dean Flores' office and others, and the development of CREMA, California Real Milk Association, Christine Chesson and others who have really come forward and supported this bill and helped create it. The bill came out of a panel of experts that contributed together about 2 months ago, and basically it says a couple of things. Number one, we are allowed to have the good bacteria in our milk, but there's intensive testing for the pathogenic or bad bacteria in our milk, which is not currently in state law. There's no intensive testing for pathogenic bacteria. So twice a week, there are pathogen tests that are split between the results of the testing are split and sent off via fax to the state representatives or regulators, I should say, so that both the dairy and the regulators know what's going on. Number one. Number two, there's a hazard analysis critical control points plan, which is a state-of-the-art food safety plan, a HACCP plan developed for every dairy that does raw milk. And therefore, there's measurement and testing and risk management of all the risks that are identified as being important all the time. And there's documentation of those things. So it's a quantum leap forward and a rise up of the standards. It's an increase of the benchmark by untold many-fold for safety. Instead of looking at good bacteria, which doesn't tell you anything about bad bacteria, you're looking specifically at bad bacteria intensively and also managing all the other risks. The bill also prohibits bringing milk from a non-raw dairy to a raw dairy and bottled into a raw dairy product. And that only makes sense as well. So there's multiple layers of opportunity for, you know, really improving safety. And the other thing is it's not forced upon any dairy that wants to do raw milk. If raw milk dairy wants to do the AB 1735 less than 10 coliform standards, they can opt to do that. So there's nothing being forced upon a dairy, and the only good thing is that you've got this wonderful alternative which provides for a many-fold improvement in food safety.
Wow. And so what happened yesterday?
Well, yesterday was the Ag Committee hearing, the Assembly Ag Committee hearing chaired by Nicole Parra. And there was a good dialogue and argument and so on and so forth. No one stood in opposition. It had broad support from not only industry but also consumers and myself and consumer organizations. And the work done by the various different committee members was really, really good, because there was a lot of communication, a lot of phone calls were received by the committee members, and it passed with unanimous support. So we're very excited it passed both committees, the Health Committee, which we thought was the hard one, and then the Ag Committee, which it seemed to be more positive for us earlier in the year. And now it goes on to other, legislative stumbling blocks, you know, things you have to get through to get to the actual assembly floor for voting. And then it'll go to the Senate floor for voting. But it's really tough, because almost anything I say or anything we do can and will be used against us on a political front. So you got to be very careful to be supportive and encouraging. And even though we're under continual pressure, like I'll use that word, in the raw milk deal here in California, it's continuing even in light of these positive things happening in the legislature. There's the old legal side where we're trying to protect our rights, and it's kind of a real tough thing to have a political fight, which everybody has to play nice, and in the legal fight where you have to fight like crazy to keep your note from being, from being put out of business.
Are they still trying to inform the California standard that's in place right now?
Yes.
Okay, so we won't ask you anything that you're not supposed to say, so we'll just let you say whatever you want here.
Well, it sounds, though, number one, encouraging, firstly, that, I mean, if we spoke a year ago, there wasn't much representation, really, of the opinions of the two major milk producers in California, let alone all this actual real data about the nature of raw milk, its health benefits, and the actual facts of the situation. And now it seems like all that data is out there, it's being discussed, it's being looked at, it's being talked about.
It's public record now.
Yeah.
Great.
It's public record. There's a six-hour DVD that's available, and a lot of that's put online already. And the transcripts of that DVD are online, and it's very compelling information. And I just hope and wish that we could get our regulators to the table and help, have them start participating with us more actively, because we really need them.
So what are the next steps?
The next steps are basically keep our cool and keep on working together as a group of people that are motivated for living food, whole foods that are biodiverse and enzyme-rich and all that good stuff we know about raw milk. And try any way you can to sign up for our email list so you can be part of our action group of action people that are actually going out there and actually calling and making the calls to demand that our food is unprocessed and whole and from natural sources. We lost almonds last year, and it's really a travesty because the almond growers in California lost 20% of their raw almond sales here in California, even though that Portuguese almonds could be brought in and sold in our markets, we couldn't sell in our own markets.
Ugh.
So that's the kind of thing going on. That's pretty tragic.
Wow.
So the easiest place for folks to sign up for the email list would be at your website?
Organicpastures.com, and then put your email right there on our homepage. Just put your email in, and it'll tell you, it'll sign you up for our email alerts. And the Weston A. Price Foundation has been extremely supportive, and CREMA, of course, is an organization separate from anything we're affiliated with. It's the voice of California's raw milk consumers, and they've been very active to be involved and engaged and have their contacts as well.
Do we have any idea how many people are raw milk drinkers or supporters out there?
We think there's about 40 to 45,000 consumers per week.
Wow.
In California.
Wow.
Yeah. And the Food Network is putting on a whole series of one-hour films this fall, the Food Network with Al Roca on the Eastern Seaboard, that talk about foods that heal. And raw milk will be in a couple of those series. And, we're fortunate in California. Raw milk is legal to be bought in stores, where other states it's not so fortunate, and it's a black market. So it's one of those things. This time has come, and with anything like this, there's a lot of dialogue, a lot of arguing, it's a force majeure. It really is.
Sure. Well, thanks to you for being out there on the front line, spending so much time helping us fight for our rights, for this freedom to choose what we want to be able to consume.
It is truly a challenge.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for catching up with us today and giving us an update, and good luck with everything. If there's anything we can do to support you further, let us know.
You're welcome, and thanks for the call.
All right,
thanks, Mark.
Bye.
Bye. That was Mark McAfee at Organic Pastures. You can find out more at organicpastures.com. And we are big raw milk fans ourselves. In fact, we have some raw milk that we just picked up that we're going to look forward to going home and making some raw kefir out of and some drink it maybe with some homemade cookies or so. We'll have to decide.
I mean, it really is the perfect food,
right? We love it.
Natural, good stuff for the body and very, very healthy and unadulterated.
And delicious. Don't forget the delicious.
Delicious, absolutely. Let's take a very, very quick musical break and we'll come right back and delve into deep bodywork understanding and healing. So hang tight.
Fire me, they burn, and if them even want to kill me, go a station, go lock me down. Them put a bridle over me face and all a bit over me tongue. Still I burn the wicked them down. I man say, ooh, them with the new world order, wah.
How the fuck them come on, yeah? Since 9-11, them a lock off the border. Them scan your face and all a x-ray your finger. Can't pass you if you ever get a ticket. If you have the ganja, please forget it. So blood and fire, me the bun. And if them even want to kill me, go on them station, go lock me down. Them put the bridle over me face and the bit over me tongue. Me still a blaze the Vatican down. Them come with a new pope, we got a new rope. Pastor still a saka saka them choke. Them come with a new pope, like them a run joke. We're gonna sink that, we now make that float. As far as I can see, Babylon run the industry. At them farm the Ku Klux Klan, the stock market and the World Bank. IMF also the Enron. Them no stamps up from the poor man. This a fire may a burn, is a worthy fire.
Welcome back to Reality Sandwich. And as you know from listening to the show week to week, we love to explore various modalities that are being utilized to help heal. Heal the human body, help heal the human mind, help us clear past traumas, anything that's really inhibiting our free flowing of maximal health, to put it broadly. And Feldenkrais is a bodywork practice that I've heard about for years, and I've always been curious, like, just what is it? Mm-hmm. What is it grounded on? I mean, I hear people mention it from place to place. Oh, it was very beneficial for this, that. Really, what is this thing? Mm-hmm. Feldenkrais? I mean, it sounds like a pretzel to me. I mean, I know this is kind of silly, but I mean, it just sounds like something interesting. I don't know. Yeah, I wouldn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. Unless somebody had told me what it was. It was based on the work of a man and all this kind of stuff that we're about to learn. But we have here in the studio Jody Friedman. She is a Guild-certified Feldenkrais practitioner. Welcome to the show, Jody.
Thank you. You know, maybe Feldenkrais is a pretzel. I've heard it being called so many things, so why not add pretzel to the list? That's great.
Okay. Well, for the current moment, until I get more educated in a few moments, I'll hold it as that, but I'll be willing to let it go.
Great.
So firstly, Feldenkrais is a bodywork practice. I mean, what does that mean?
It is a bodywork practice, but it's also a lot more than a bodywork practice. Most people think of it as such, and people who have an injury, a knee injury, some sort of chronic pain, those are the types of people who could come to see a certified Feldenkrais practitioner. But it's not just for people with injuries, although that's how most people come into the door. The problem is when people injure themselves and then they go to physical therapy, they are learning and relearning to strengthen the muscles around the injury. But if you continue to move in the habitual ways that caused the injury in the first place, more than likely that injury is going to come up again. Mm. So what Feldenkrais does is brings an awareness to your movements and how you move, and maybe not just that part, but how your knee, for example, is connected to the whole of you. So you can look at more of a holistic, more of a bigger picture of how you're moving, and then provide you with other options and other ways of actually physically moving through space, which also allows your brain to create new pathways to give it other options and other choices and areas in your life. So there are three types of people who can come to Feldenkrais, which is kind of a long way to answer your question. One is someone who's been injured. Two is someone who's at the top of their game physically, whether you're an athlete or a musician or a dancer or a singer or any of those things, and they're kind of stuck. They're at a plateau. They've become as good as they can come and become in their field, and they want to get to that next level, and they don't exactly know what's holding them back. Mm. We work with people like that. The third type of people we work with, although this isn't usually why they come into the door, is someone who's just stuck. They're stuck in their own fears. They're stuck in their own story. They've done a lot of talk therapy. They've done a lot of meditation, maybe they've done a lot of Western doctor looking at lots of combinations of things, and they can't seem to get past their story and into their body and create the changes that they want in their life.
Mm. Mm. Boy, there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, there is.
You know, there is a lot of stuckness. And how do people generally find Feldenkrais? Because when I hear some of these things, you know, I typically think, you know, somebody's in pain, right? I guess their default is to go to a doctor. Or, you know, maybe a chiropractor if it's back pain or something like this. How do people generally get introduced to this modality?
That's a great question. Feldenkrais has been around. Moshe really started the movement in the 1940s in Israel. I'm going to back up and give you a little history and then kind of get to how you can find someone here today. He had a knee injury. He blew out his knee. He was a semi-pro soccer player, in addition to all the other things he was doing in his life, judo, et cetera, and they wanted him to have knee replacement surgery in the 40s in Israel. And he said, well, can I play soccer again if I do that? And they said, no, our technology is not that good. So he refused. And he was on the floor playing with his little niece or nephew, I can't remember which. And he was on the floor with this kid for an hour, and he did everything that this child did, and he was exhausted at the end of that hour. And he started thinking, what are we born with? What do we know coming into the world as an infant about how we organize our spine, how we do things, that as an adult, through habitual patterns, through genetics, through our life choices, through limiting our options, that we forget how we're organized? And he started studying the body, looked at chiropractic as well, was a judo master, lots of kind of Western and Eastern approaches to things, and came up with this, his own methodology, which is called the Feldenkrais method, K-R-A-I-S. So the way someone finds a practitioner today, there's a guild website that you can go to look up the Feldenkrais practitioner. And I can get you, I don't know the website off the top of my head, but I can get you the address, and you can say it on your show next week.
It always fascinates me when I hear a field of study that stems from the work of one man, you know, and I wonder, you know, what a remarkable life this one person must have had. Of what was in, what were they thinking? What were they studying, such that their curiosities led to the creation of a discipline that's now being practiced by people, you know, all around the world.
Well, it kind of reminds us of the art of learning that we heard last week from Josh Waitzkin about, or 2 weeks ago, I guess, about just the process of learning and being in the flow and all of that. So it sounds very similar to me, just in terms of that exploration, that open-minded exploration.
Feldenkrais had a lot to say about how we learn, and he was pretty against the fact of being given an answer and really wanted you to discover for yourself. So that way, as a practitioner, when I'm working with someone, I'm never going to say, no, that's the wrong way to do it. He believed that the body had an innate wisdom, and if there's a reason that you're slouching and limping to the left, it's because that's what your body thinks it needs to do to protect itself. And far be it for him to change what your body thinks it needs to do. He will give you options, that the method will give you an awareness to move differently. It's like a story I was telling you, Julie, a couple weeks ago about an infant. They did a study with infants learning to drink from a cup, not a sippy cup, but an actual cup. They're at that stage of their development. In one group, they showed the children how to hold the cup, what to do with the cup, and in a couple of tries, they pretty much got it, and they were fine. Another group, they just gave them the cup, let them play with the cup, let them explore with that cup. And it took them about 2 weeks to really learn how to drink from the adult cup.
As they were spilling water all over.
As they were spilling water and having a great old time. No one told them that was wrong or bad or whatever it was. And then what they did is they changed the size and the shape of the cup on both groups. And the group who had been taught how to drink properly, quote-unquote properly, started crying. They needed help. They needed someone to do it for them. And the group who had explored very quickly learned how to use the other cup, because they were open to different possibilities, and there wasn't just one way to do something. And he feels in education today so much is this is the way you do it.
Right.
This is the you know, there is no room for creativity. There is no room for difference. There is no room for anything. So he believes in working with you as you are, not trying to change who you are, and just presenting opportunities in ways for you to create awareness, which may lead to changes that you want to make and that you're ready to make in your time.
And I would think that doesn't only affect someone's level of frustration or someone's level of learning, but also someone's, I would think, belief of themselves or their self-esteem, because the group that were taught how to do it and then they didn't know how to do it the second time, not only were they upset and frustrated, but how might that have an effect on them in terms of who knows how they feel about themselves or the world around them or something.
That's a really interesting point. I know for me, when I was a student in the program, I always wanted, there was this part of me that knew how to be a really good student, and I wanted to please my trainers and please my teacher. And that's just not the game in Feldenkrais. It's really about your own growth and your own learning. And there were it wasn't that type of situation. So your self-esteem takes huge leaps and bounds, but it's not because some sort of external source is saying, you did a good job,
right,
Jody. It's because you feel and sense that change, whether it's a small thing internally, externally. I mean, that's kind of why I went into it. I was having knee problems and didn't have a good sense of my center and who I was never a physical person, was never that comfortable in my own body. Although most people who go into it are professional dancers or athletes or already massage therapists or physical therapists. I wasn't, and they kept talking about this amorphous center, your center. I'm like, oh, I don't think I have a center. I found it.
So for people that have never heard of somatics or don't really understand the connection of the body to the brain or the psyche or whatever, can you maybe explain a little bit about how these are connected or how working on the body could help with some of these other challenges of the mind and that?
Yeah, I can. Feldenkrais was a big believer in using the imagination and sometimes just even imagining movements as opposed to actually doing them. And that actually created great, great change in things just by using the imagination. Science today has really backed up everything that Feldenkrais postulated, although he was not a scientist. And even as a practitioner, we do not diagnose. We just want to work with you as you are. But he felt like even if you could imagine and create that change in your mind, that would actually start the connections between your body, your mind, and your spirit.
Mm.
And personally, for me, that was the hardest thing to get around. I can't imagine moving my finger without actually moving my finger. Mm-hmm. Well, can I move it a little bit? Can I kind of sort of move it? And the answer was yes. Do whatever you need to do to start to do that.
Huh.
And I find with a lot of people who are really mired in their story of, let me tell you about my pain, let me tell you about my suffering, although they probably wouldn't even know it, and I certainly wouldn't say it to them, they don't even want to admit that they're not ready for change. They just want to tell their story and be heard. But real healing doesn't really take place if you're just going to beat yourself up over and over again with your story. You have to be able to imagine different ways of doing things and different possibilities. And Feldenkrais felt the best way to get out of your head was to get into your body, to feel your sits bones. Right now, as you're sitting here, wherever you are, if you focus in on your sits bone, is you have more weight on your left side of your butt, basically, or the right side of your butt, and can you switch it?
Mm-hmm.
Can you switch from one side to the other? We're not trying to do anything obscene here, but, can you change how you're habitually sitting when you get into the car? We have a way that we have to sit. We have our hands on the steering wheel in a certain position. I mean, obviously, you want to be safe and have access to what you need to do to drive safely, but what can you do to change a habit, any habit? And once you can change something small, perhaps you can tackle bigger questions in your life. Like the first habit that I picked in the beginning of my training was I always brush my teeth with my right hand. And I thought, okay, I'll brush my teeth with my left hand. And I hated it. I was mad at my teacher for making me do this when in truth he wasn't making me do this. Why did I have to do it? I did a fine job. I wasn't getting any cavities. Gosh darn it. What never occurred to me was the fact that I actually could do the exercise with my left hand and then go back and brush them with my right hand so I could get a good brushing.
No.
I had to be a purist and stick to the rules, and there were no options. I just didn't think about options. And after about 2 weeks, I could brush with my left hand. I didn't like it, but I could do a good job with it, and I wasn't so angry about it anymore. Now, I could have just spent 2 weeks complaining about my story and how angry I was.
And how stupid the exercise was.
Yeah, but instead I just got it into a bodily experience. So the idea that there isn't a connection between the mind and the body is just baffling to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we've let that one go a long time ago here on this show. I mean, as far as just realizing how much what's going on in our head affects what's the processing that's in our body, we've had a lot of different discussions about how we use this collective term of like trauma, right? Things being stored in the body.
Right.
And so let's talk about kind of an example of, and we'll use a pretty generic example of physical pain. Someone who is experiencing physical pain, can we pick back pain as a common example? What is the Feldenkrais practitioner or that modality think about the person who's coming in with that, sort of the origins of that or how that's affecting the body?
Right. That's a great, great question. And we do a lot of work with people in pain. The connection, I mean, pain is real. Whether it's imagined pain or even if it is imagined pain, it's real to that person. And whether you can measure it on a scale or not doesn't matter because it's real to that person. And sometimes they're in so much pain they can't increase their awareness beyond the pain to see what's going on outside of the pain. All this is, my back hurts. It doesn't matter that my ear doesn't hurt. It just matters that my back does hurt.
Right.
So one of the things that we look at in Feldenkrais is how to get the body into a state of neutral, as opposed to a state of positiveness, which can be really hard. Oh, don't focus on the back pain, honey.
Right.
Focus on the fact that you had strawberry shortcake
or
whatever it is that makes you happy in your life. But so, okay, yes, we have back pain there, and we're not gonna try to take that away from you. That's your pain. You can own it. You can claim it. You can do whatever you want with it. But let's focus on other areas, everybody. What's feeling neutral right now? Not necessarily good, not necessarily bad. And just getting yourself off of that pain and onto something else that isn't going to spark an intense, big reaction. And then getting someone to work with kind of the powerful things that we all know about in somatic practices, like the breath. Following three breaths from beginning to end. The inhale. Some people hold the breath before they exhale. Some people hold there's different ways people go through an entire cycle of breathing. But if you can get someone to follow three breaths all the way through and be aware of how they're making contact with whatever they're seated on or standing or laying down on, a lot of that excess noise around the pain goes away. A lot of people come in there like, I want to work with my back. This is the part of my back that hurts. I want to work with it. Well, if you're in pain there, Feldenkrais very, very much believed, and I've seen this over and over again, that you can't learn if the body's in a state of stress or in a state of pain. That doesn't create learning. That's why when you're in the gym and you're doing reps and this and that, that your body's just stressing. And not that that isn't a way to build muscle strength, but it's not a real way to have something stick and stay with you for the long term. So he would be an advocate of acknowledging the pain, listening to a little bit of the story, but this is not a talk therapy session. Yes, you have pain there. And so I might work on someone's foot if they have shoulder pain. And a lot of people are like, I'm paying you to work to do what? And you're not even going to touch the area that's hurting. And then at the end of the session, they're, oh, I'm actually walking differently. I'm actually moving differently. Oh, this is a different possibility. And as a practitioner, I make it really clear not to tell them, oh, here was my thinking. I am thinking that your foot actually has a connection to how you make contact with the ground that moves up through your hips, through your vertebral column into your ribs, and that's what I'm seeing when you're walking, sweetheart. I'm not going to do any of that because I don't know the person's experience as well as that person knows their experience. But what they will know is something's different. And if that gets them to focus on their foot and not on their pain and realize, oh, I can create change without just being focused on the negative. There you go. There's a huge shift in thinking. And so he worked a lot with pain. And I also wanted to go back when he studied with a lot of different people and had a lot of different beliefs. Gurdjieff, the Turkish whirling dervish guys who spin for hours and hours and hours. He was fascinated with how they could keep their center and their balance and do that meditative spin for hours. That was one of his big teachers and a lot of other people. So he pulled from many other people as well. And unfortunately, I don't know enough about all the different people he pulled from, but he was a pretty eclectic guy.
Wow. I've also heard, since my work being in autism, I've also heard of Feldenkrais being used in a variety of different brain injuries or something where they're working more with that, those aspects of whether it's mental, behavioral. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there are lots of people who work very specifically with children, and like CP, cerebral palsy is huge for this. I've heard of some work with autism too, though I don't know much about it. But children, it's a much different, obviously, if you're working with children in any capacity, it's very different. You can't just say, lie on a table and let's do this.
Right.
But you do it through some sort of a creative play. But their brains are not locked into habits so much unless they have something like a traumatic brain injury and this and that. Very early they've learned to shrink or to cope or to do it, whatever. But if you can, through play, reach them, you see changes in them very quickly. Also stroke patients. Feldenkrais had a stroke in England. I don't know if it was in the 70s or the 80s, and he didn't have any identification on him, so they just like put him in a hospital. And within 3 days, he was fine. He had like retrained his brain and through imagination, and he was out there like, this is not normal. What just happened to this man? But he was so strong and powerful in using his imagination and his intention that he rid himself of the causes, and he actually retrained his brain.
Wow.
Within a very short, I mean, the guy's miraculous, and most of us, I mean, I'm never going to reach that point in my life, at least I don't believe, but the skills that it has taught me and what I've been able to give to others been remarkable. It's interesting, one of my first clients was a man who didn't speak English. So I'm a person who relies on my words in my, my regular life. I'm a teacher. So here I was really just having the body experience. He had lost his thumb and was having shoulder pain. It had been reattached And they told him he had carpal tunnel syndrome. And it was very clear to me that that wasn't what he had, but I don't diagnose, mm-hmm. and I don't speak his language anyway. He's from Mexico. So we just communicated through simple movements of the body. And by the end of it, he was smiling and clapping and paid me. So, you know, it was all good.
Wow.
There's a term that we mentioned before, we were talking before the show, brain plasticity.
Yeah.
And the opening up of new options within the brain. And this is a theme that I just keep hearing in different modalities, which is that what's going on in the brain is not fixed. You know, you hear from so many sources that, mm-hmm. you know, such and such is a permanent situation, or this is permanent, or this can't change. And I keep hearing from multi different modalities and different scientific people and all these different factors how much influence we can still have on what the brain, my goodness, the most powerful organism, you know, known to, you know, universe, has actually the ability to learn and change and shift itself throughout its own existence.
Yeah, absolutely true. And you're talking to the biggest pessimist on the planet, me. And so maybe, I don't know how I was fortunate enough to find Feldenkrais or many of these modalities that are saying the brain can change. And through change, making changes in the body, that's making changes that are so much bigger that we are just beginning to understand on a scientific level, but Feldenkrais knew for a long time. I want to talk about the two different ways people can do or can use Feldenkrais.
Great.
Just so people know. So a lot of classes in the Bay Area are being offered in Feldenkrais awareness through movement classes. They're called ATM, not like automatic, what is the
teller
cash
machine?
Automatic teller machine or whatever, but awareness through movement. And that's a name Moshe coined, I don't know, many, many years ago. Moshe Feldenkrais. And that's a group class where you're guided through a series of gentle, simple movements by a certified Feldenkrais practitioner. You lay on the floor, you lay on a mat, you wear kind of comfortable, loose clothing. It's about 45 minutes to an hour for a session, and you begin by walking usually at the session, and then you end it by walking, and you kind of notice changes or differences. And that's very popular. They're pretty inexpensive, $12, $15. Kaiser offers them. They're offered throughout San Francisco. Many different places do that. And so that's one way to experience Feldenkrais in kind of a low-level money commitment.
Mm-hmm.
The other way is a one-on-one session where you go to a studio or wherever a Feldenkrais practitioner has a table, and he or she works with you one-on-one for, again, about 45 minutes to an hour, where you lay on a table fully clothed, and the practitioner, you're more passive, and the practitioner guides you through a series of these gentle movements. We hear a little bit of your story to begin with, you know, what's going on for you. We don't want you to do anything that feels uncomfortable, anything that puts you in pain. Mm. It's not like you need to tough it out and this will be good for you. Everything should feel pleasurable. Feldenkrais had a theory, make the impossible possible, the possible easy, and the easy elegant. For instance, I never thought I could dance, and through Feldenkrais, I found myself being willing to try it a little bit. I can't say I'm at the elegant phase by any means, but it's not impossible anymore.
Hmm.
And that was something that I was so. It's actually changed my self-image. Hmm. It's softened me,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I needed from it. Maybe other people need to have more of an edge or whatever you need, mm-hmm. but just the idea that you're aware of who you are and what you do without judgment, without beating yourself up about it. And that through the body, you can create the changes that you want to create in your life.
Wow. And so in these either group classes or private classes, is it intense physical exertion? Is it very mild, more meditative? What are people doing in these sessions?
In a one-on-one session, which is called an FI, functional integration is what it's called, you're pretty passive on the table, although you're not asleep. It's not like getting a massage.
Mm-hmm.
I may ask you, notice what happens in your shoulder when you move like this. What do you feel like? One of the ways we start is when someone's laying down on their back, so I'll say, roll your head to the side. You know, roll your head gently from side to side. And I'll say, well, what side did you roll to first? Why did you roll to that side? Is it easier to roll your head to that side? So I want them to be engaged in why these unconscious choices that we make, why did you make the choices that you made?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer may be, I don't know, which is a perfectly wonderful answer. Because once you know, you're kind of, you've canceled out all possibilities. I have a friend that says, beware the temptation of certainty. It's not Feldenkrais, but I love it. Mm. So it's nothing physically exerting. It's very relaxing. It's very pleasurable. And you're making connections between things that you just didn't think about making connections between, like the relationship between your ankle and the middle of your back.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Most people don't think about that.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I had a friend who just went through 10 sessions of Rolfing.
Yep.
And it was great for her. I mean, it you know, people believe whatever they believe. And there's so many different modalities. I'm not dissing any one of them. But she still had pain behind her knee, on the inside of her knee, at the end of those sessions. And she's like, I've been massaged. I've been Rolfed. I've done everything. I still have this pain. So I said, you know, let me take a look. And I started playing around with it. And I was like, I found a connection between there and her heel. And what I found is she couldn't push out her heel. Her heel was in a constant state of, like, up, up, up. And, you know, the ability to extend your heel down mm-hmm. towards the floor. So all those muscles in the top of her calf were chronically tight. So once I was like, hey, let's just play with this motion. She's like, but that has nothing to do with my knee. I said, I know. But still, let's play. I'm going to put a piece of paper by your heel, and you just flick it away. Flick it away with your heel. Flick it away. She's like, oh, and like the big smile came on her face and her eyes got opened really wide. So it was like, here's something she knew she could obviously do. That's the foot we drive with. So all sorts of funky stuff happens mm-hmm. around that ankle. And I just was with her again last night, 2 days later, and it feels so different. And
wow.
For her, it was really cool.
Wow.
It's quite amazing how disconnected we typically get from what's going on in our bodies, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You know, and how much we're walking around tolerating discomfort mm-hmm. somewhere within our physical system. And, you know, there's so many interesting ways to alleviate those challenges. How do we help people to become comfortable, firstly, with the notion of dealing with what's going on in their body and actually getting in touch with that?
You know, Feldenkrais once said the most elegant man he ever met was a hunchback. And there was a man who he was born with the hump on his back, mm-hmm. and he accepted who he was, and through that he learned to move in his hunchback way as beautiful as he can. So I think part of it is accepting who you are. Mm. You know, you're not going to become a world-class gymnast if, you know, you were born with these certain genetic predispositions, so that's not going to happen for you. But you can get to be the best you can be, and accepting and saying hello to all the different parts of you is a great way to start with that, and mm. Feldenkrais would be in that line of thinking.
Now, I'm assuming for people that are maybe very fast-paced, busy, never really spend any time doing any body-centered activities,
yeah.
This might be kind of a scary thought for them.
It is scary, and we wouldn't want, if they're fast-paced type people, then I'm not going to get them to relax and feel into their bodies. That's not the way. You have to work with a person where they are. Mm. So I would give them different challenges. We work with these soft rollers, mm-hmm. and I would put them on the roller, and I would have them work maybe with one leg or the other, and I would give them a series of small challenges and let them really kind of focus in on it from that perspective. Mm. There are other people that need to slow down, other people that need to – you can't make someone try to learn a modality in a way that they're not comfortable with. Mm-hmm. You got to go in the way – that they can go in.
So is there one, I don't want to say better than another, but if someone were going to experience Feldenkrais, would a group class be a good way? Would a private session be? How might someone explore this if it's totally new to them and they've never maybe even done any body-centered things before?
I guess it would be, they would have to be curious about what they wanted. I mean, if they were in chronic pain, laying down on the floor may not be the way to do it because that's more of a generic session. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rule is there. You only do what you feel comfortable doing, of course, but I would say a one-on-one session. Mm-hmm. And talking to the practitioner first, making sure it's the right fit, you know, what's your area of emphasis, expertise. You know, a lot of people are coming from fear, and they let the fear hold back from their experience. They miss out on a lot on life, so I try to really acknowledge and work with, and as do all practitioners, the areas that they're comfortable. Either way, it is a doorway into a new way of thinking in mm-hmm. a really safe, respectful way. It's changed my life and the people that I have touched with it. And I'm so thankful that this modality and other modalities are around and that science is actually kind of catching up to what the Feldenkrais community has known for a really long time.
Mm.
Yeah. In what ways is that taking place? I mean, in what ways is the scientific developments of today validating the types of things that he was pondering that's actually going on in the body?
Well, I'm thinking about the series that's on PBS right now about seniors. You can buy that kit. So, you know, stay young. It's not just about doing crossword puzzles. Your brain can actually rejuvenate itself, and people are spending, you know, tons of money to relearn. And that's basically what Feldenkrais has been saying all the time. You can relearn things. So there's that type of growing. I see articles, you know, on NPR and the New York Times. Just everybody seems to be catching up. That seems to be the new science today. And for me, it's not a new science. It's it's the secret and the gift that I've been working with for about 10 years and some people have been working with for 50 years. I mean, Feldenkrais died in the 80s, and so the movement is continuing on without him. And I want to say one more thing about that is the beauty of what he did in his work is he didn't want it to be exactly how he did it. We were not little Feldenkraisian clones. Everyone brings their own interest. I have a friend who only works with musicians, and another friend who only works in Japanese with ballet dancers, and another friend, and not that I work with anybody who wants to work with me, but some people only work with children. So you take your passion and your curiosities and what you're interested in. Some people really combine it with Zen meditation or another practice called focusing, which is another wonderful tool to talk about brain elasticity. So there are many different applications, but it all comes down to bringing an awareness to what you do and being open and ready to create the change that you want in your life.
Mm.
So what's involved in becoming a practitioner of this?
It's quite a commitment. I took classes for about 5 or 6 years and then a lot of one-on-one functional integration sessions before I was ready to commit with this, and I couldn't fight it anymore. It was just clear that this was the path I needed to go on. It's a 4-year training program. You know, I can't remember how many hours that is. I know for the way we did it, it was 10 weeks in the summer, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. Some
wow.
people do it weekends, 12 months a year. Some people do it 3 weeks at a time. So I don't know what the hours stem up to. In that, you learn some anatomy, some physiology as well, and then you're instructed in how to bring your wisdom and your passion to what it is. You work with people one-on-one. You have free clinics that you work with people. You teach group classes. So you do all of the different things. But there's not a formula. It's not like this. It was such a different type of learning, especially me as a teacher. I want to know beginning, middle, end. I want the structure. I want all of
right.
that. And it's absolutely not that type of learning. And to know that you can learn in a way that really makes you hear and understand what's best for you is a blessing.
Wow.
Mm. We've been speaking with Jody Friedman. She is a Guild-certified Feldenkrais practitioner. We're learning all about the somatic bodywork practice and healing practice of Feldenkrais. And in the past last few minutes we have here, Jody, I want to ask you, you've been studying this now for years, as you just mentioned. It seems to be your life's work arriving within you and coming through you. How do you most want to apply it? What kind of people do you most want to be helping with this?
Well, that's a juicy question. I teach kids. Like, one of the things I'll do is I'll have a kid who's, you know, ADD or a little, can't sit still, a little ootsy, as we like to say. And he can't focus on our silent reading time. So I'll just start thinking in a Feldenkraisian way. What are options? What are things I can do differently? So I take the book and I'll say, Johnny, or whatever the kid's name is, I want you to read this book upside down. I want you to hold the book upside down. What? What? Yeah, just do it. And all of a sudden, wow. You know, he thinks something's impossible. He turns the book upside down. It's fun. It's a new game. He's interested. He's reading. He can tell me back what he's reading. So it's just providing options for people is one way. The other way is there's another modality called focusing, where you're working, getting a felt sense of what's going on in your body through kind of a talk therapy, and then you ground it in your body. A whole nother radio show, a whole nother discussion. I've been studying that for a year. So working with people, it's more in a psychological vein, but using that awareness and Feldenkraisian awareness. I just see so many applications for it, whether I'm still discovering how exactly I want to use it. I'm happy being a Feldenkrais practitioner, but I write a column, I do other things, and it just expands options. It expands options and ways for me to think about things that I'm so appreciative of. And when I get stuck, it helps me get unstuck.
Well, that really gets to the core of the purpose for us having a radio show called Reality Sandwich and a practice called Healthful Living, and specifically that, to help people provide them more options so they've got more knowledge and awareness of what's possible, hence to help them be either unstuck or to improve life in some regard, to improve health in some regard by knowing that there's more that is possible for themselves that they can actually step out and utilize.
And not just possible, but maybe perhaps even easy or elegant.
Yeah, imagine.
So I know that you wouldn't necessarily be brushing your teeth during a Feldenkrais practice,
no.
But it sounds like there are ways you can invite Feldenkrais thinking into things you might be doing.
Yeah.
If somebody wanted to just for fun do a little fun exercise to kind of get a new sense of learning or explore or open up something new, do you have any ideas for people of something they could switch up in their life, like put their pants on the other leg first, or you know,
yeah,
anything?
Absolutely. You know, brushing your teeth, putting your underwear on with the other, you know, foot first, or just changing any sort of simple pattern that doesn't have a lot of story or a lot of negative or a lot of emotion to it. Something simple. Change something simple. Maybe don't turn on the radio in your car for the first 5 minutes if you habitually do that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe wait 10 minutes and see what that's like. What feelings does that bring up with you? Where do you feel uncomfortable? Where's the anxiety? Where's the habitual tension that's happening there? Notice what that is and see what happens if you actually can let that feeling grow. You know, what physical changes take place when you don't get what you want immediately.
Mm, and you don't have to solve it or answer it or psychoanalyze it. Just be with
it. Please don't, yeah.
Right.
Wow, wonderful. Well, you have been listening to Jody Friedman with Julie and Martin Matthews here on KPOO San Francisco. You're listening to Reality Sandwich, a palatable the taste of the truth coming to you at your lunchtime hour. You can listen to our show every Thursday at noon and get all copies of our old shows at realitysandwichradio.com. Thanks for listening.